Deputy Prosecuting Attorney. Argument on the merits.
All right. Good morning, Mr. Lum and Mr. Anderson. Are you both ready to proceed today? Mr. Anderson? All right, Mr. Lum, you've reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal, so we'll have a warning light come on with 10 minutes to go. And Mr. Anderson, we will give you a warning with 5 minutes to go. Please proceed, Mr. Lum. Thank you.
Thank you, John. May I please, members of the Honorable Court, I have received, I guess, based on the order that was filed by the Supreme Court back on August 12th, looks like the court is focusing on the merger question regarding the kidnapping and the robbery. As I pointed out in my supplemental brief, I'm just questioning whether there is any mechanism for the circuit court to reconsider its ruling, because looking at prior cases.
And Mr. Lum, let me just say, you should feel free to raise anything that is in your cert app, though, so that you think is relevant to the court.
Okay. So I'll address this first, and then if I have time, I'll move on to some of the other issues I raised in my petition for cert. So one of the questions is whether the circuit court has the power or the mechanism to reconsider its prior dismissal of the count one robbery charge, because there is the 10-day rule for a motion for reconsideration, but that is passed. Looking at the HRPP Rule 35 regarding correction of an illegal sentence, it seems to say that you have 90 days that if you file, if there's a motion or request to the court within 90 days after imposition of sentence, the court can correct its illegal sentence after that time has passed. Then you, I guess, they put it on the petitioner or defendant to file a Rule 40. But as you said, the 90 days have also passed because we're well into the period of the year.
Well, doesn't this court sometimes rule that a sentence is improper or illegal for whatever reason and order resentencing pursuant to the guidelines set by this court?
Yes.
And we don't worry about deadlines in those situations, do we?
Yes, Your Honor. But in those situations, looking at those cases such as, I guess one of the cases I cited was Alterson, the Supreme Court vacated the judgment or the order before remanding it. That's what, looking at the question, it says whether the circuit court should reconsider its decision to dismiss. So that's why I'm questioning whether the circuit court can on its own reconsider, or whether I'm saying that it should be the higher court that has general supervisory power that either vacates the order of dismissal or vacates the entire judgment and then remands. But that's why I'm just saying that I don't see where the circuit court itself would have, after the time period, statutory time period has passed, whether it can reconsider its own order of dismissal. So I think it's going to be up to the Supreme Court to either vacate the judgment or the order of dismissal by exercising its general supervisory powers. Because I think otherwise, then it kind of opens the door whether the circuit court has this inherent power, I guess, under Moriwaki at any time to set aside a prior order. So just as I said, I'm looking at the mechanism, and I think that it would have to be the Supreme Court that's exercising its general supervisory power rather than leaving that simply up to the circuit court to reconsider, because on a reconsideration, it would just be abuse of discretion. The second question regarding whether there would be a merger of the kidnapping counts into the robbery counts or vice versa, we believe that it, if you look at 701.109.1e, when they talk
just
about...
Just so I'm clear, Mr. Lum, you want us to vacate the sentence in its entirety? Is that what you're asking of us? And then to sentence him ourselves or to have the circuit court do that? Well, what exactly are you asking us to do?
Well, I guess our first priority was to get a new trial, but if you
with regard to the sentencing issue, and you can certainly talk about the merits, you know, but assuming that we are just talking about the sentencing issue, what are you asking for us to do there?
Okay. Well, we would be asking for the Supreme Court to vacate the judgment, because the judgment is the one that imposed terms on the four kidnapping counts and dismissed the robbery count from count one. So in order to do a resentencing, that judgment would have to be vacated. And then it can be remanded to the circuit court with his instructions in light of HRS 701-109-1E, whether I guess that, well, with instructions that he should only be stand convicted of that count one robbery count. And therefore, we're just asking for resentencing or resentencing or remand and resentencing on the count one for the robbery second, because the jury did, I guess when they convicted him, found him guilty only of the included offense.
So vacate everything, send it back to the circuit court with a direction to convict him on count one. Is that, in a nutshell, what you're asking for?
On count one as a Class B robbery second felony.
Now, why not leave that to the decision? Assuming we were to vacate, why not leave it to the circuit court to determine whether to merge the counts in one direction or the other direction in the exercise of its discretion and based on its understanding of the conduct of this case?
Well, we believe that as a matter of law, as we pointed out, unlike prior cases, we do have the jury which answered interrogatories regarding whether there was a single course of conduct, which they did. Unlike other prior cases where there was no merger instruction or they found that there was no merger, in case there is an actual factual finding from the jury as to all the four kidnapping counts, 2, 3, 4, and 5, that it was all part of the single course of conduct, namely the robbery of the IALQ pool hall. Going to 701-109-1E, once again, it says, well, the commentary, if there's just one course of criminal conduct, then the person should be convicted of no more than the one offense. In this case, it's more logical that the one offense is the robbery second, because the kidnapping or restraint of the other employees and patrons of the pool hall was incidental.
Mr. Lum, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but is it clear from the record that the circuit court judge anticipated the merger that you're describing now? It would seem that the circuit court judge indicated that if they were all Class B felonies, that the kidnapping would be merged into the robbery.
I believe that was the court's indication. But that's why we're saying that. Looking at the plain language of 701-109-1E, it should actually be the other way around, that it was the kidnapping counts, since they were incidental to the robbery, that should have merged and should have only had that single conviction for robbery in the second degree.
But although part of one overall course of conduct, could not the circuit court find that each of those kidnappings represented a separate harm and that a more appropriate sentence would be to merge the robbery into the kidnappings? Or is it your position that it's precluded as a matter of law from doing so?
Yes, so that, once again, going to the plain language of 701-109-1E, they talk about, once again, that you should not be convicted of more than one offense, and the more appropriate one is the, or the overarching or underlying offense of robbery in the second.
So as a matter of law, you would say you could not merge the robbery into the four kidnappings, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Does the judgment here reference the dismissal of the robbery count?
I believe that's I was referring to the judgment. I believe that there was, as part of the judgment, saying that count one was being dismissed.
Okay. All right.
So there was no separate.
No separate order.
Just contained within the judgment of conviction.
Mr. Lum, was going to ask you if you finished that point, if you could speak to the decision of the circuit court to exclude the prior bad acts that the defense sought to admit based on a Rule 403 analysis. And I believe that the matters that were excluded in part with the idea that they would be overly prejudicial and to some extent would be redundant. What was your response to that?
Well, in the ruling of the motion to eliminate, the circuit court seemed to actually start off by stating it was agreeing with the prosecutor that it was untimely because it was contained in an email. out to the prosecutor about 2 weeks before trial.
But the testimony was allowed as to the prior bad act, at least, of the defendant witnessing the injury that was caused to a gentleman by Mr. Tu, I think it was, when he smashed his face into a windshield.
Yes, so the court, and ruling on the motion, then they only allowed that one incident. We would argue that...
Well, the court was going to also allow the testimony that Daguerre was aware that a murder had been committed by Mr. Wu, was it?
By, I believe, Mr. Tao.
Mr. Tao, rather, yeah.
I think that the court did say it was allowed, but it appeared that, I guess, as a matter, because it would, I guess, open the doors to certain other things that the, I guess, defense counsel decided not to go into that specific area.
Well, given that testimony, why would you take the position that it was error to exclude the testimony regarding a Mr. Tao being a strong arm, or Mr. Tao stating that he had just gotten out of jail?
Well, we believe that goes to, as I said, the choice of evils and the duress defense, because especially for the duress, it says whether a person of reasonable firmness would be able to resist. We're stating that, we're arguing that just the one incident regarding Tao is not enough, that if it was shown that Mr. Daguerre was aware that Tao was involved as a strong-arm person and that Wu was involved as, I guess, a protector for these drug dealers in the Aiea area, that it does go to whether he would be able to resist them when they say, you know, we need this, we need you to help us on this, and when they physically threatened him. Once again, just the one incident regarding Tao, we believe, was not enough to establish that, but showing that Mr. Daguerre had this knowledge of them prior to this, and that they had a history of not just, I guess, involved in criminal behavior, but that they're, I guess, when you talk about being a strong arm or protector for criminal organizations, that they're willing to use force to get what they want, and to that they have no compunctions about, I guess, what they're doing. It also ties in with what Mr. Daguerre was arguing at trial, that when Mr. Wu got him involved in it, or told him to help, Wu indicated that the people in the pool hall were his friends and that they would let him in. And this, it kind of ties, well, it's kind of corroborated because the testimony from one of the persons, to Beltran, when he went to the back door, when he heard the knocking, according to him, that the door was locked, but it was Lacuna who unlocked it. And there's a question, you know, why would you unlock the door for somebody who's knocking at 2 a.m. in the morning? Lacuna claimed that, on the other hand, that he was helping to try to latch the door and close it when somebody pushed themselves in. But there is also David Tao's testimony that when he was there, he was watching Wu, and once again, Tao was one of the co-defendants who reached a plea agreement with the state, so it's not like he was here to help the defendant. But Tao was saying that he saw Wu tell them that he had some kind of connection with the people inside Ayapu, and that when they went to that back door, he saw Wu knock on the door and heard Wu say, "It's me, open the door." So once again, it's...
And how is that useful to the defense that those individuals knew Wu and allowed him into the establishment?
That was one of the things that was asserted by Mr. Daguerre, and it kind of ties in with the choice of evils, because when you compare, okay, that his helping them or get inside, if you believe that they were actually, I guess, it was, I guess, what you call an inside job, that it goes to the defense that he believed that the harm or evil that he was, I guess, facing, namely being threatened with physical force or physical injury, was less than this alleged harm or evil, since this was supposedly an inside job where nobody would get hurt.
Just coming back to the merger issue, what's your position, if I understand the state, and we'll hear from Mr. Anderson in a moment, suggests it might be allowed to elect which counts to proceed on. What's your response to that?
Once again, we believe that as a matter of law, it's the kidnapping counts that merge into the robbery. The cases cited by the prosecution, once again, are cases where there was no merger instruction that was given to the jury, and so you don't have any factual determinations on the 701-109 question. In this case, we do. So it would be, once again, more logical to follow the factual findings of the jury regarding whether there was a single course of conduct. The cases gave the prosecution that option of trying to elect was basically to remedy the situation when no merger instruction was given to the jury. So in this case, we're not looking at a remedial position. We're just saying that follow the law under 701-109 and the findings that were made by the jury.
Well, Mr. Lum, with respect to the authority that you've just mentioned, I mean, the Padilla case, I have a sympathy for the trial judge there, given the fact that there was no request for a merger. But nonetheless, isn't Padilla different from the point of view that the two offenses at issue, felon in possession and place to keep, seem to be based on a theory that was quite similar in terms of the intent of the defendant and the nature or the purpose of the offense? That is, a place to keep and felon in possession were essentially rising from the same intent as well as essentially the same set of facts.
Yes. Padilla is on that. It was, I guess, looking at those facts, but once again, it was turning towards the prosecution to make that decision on whether they want to proceed on one or the other. What position is that in this case, the prosecution, even though they want to have that option at this time, it's, I guess, too late because in order to do that at this time, they'd have to basically overturn the jury's findings.
Mr. Lum, just so I understand your position, if there was an incident involving a kidnapping with four separate people who were kidnapped, say they were in a car, there was a carjacking, four people are kidnapped, four counts, guilty on all four counts, part of a single course of conduct, is it your position that there would be only one count of conviction in that case? As a matter of law, there could be only one count of conviction when four individuals were in the car?
Based on the jury findings, if
same course of conduct, one course of conduct, which was to kidnap all four individuals in that car.
So if there was just that one course of conduct, I guess the language from the case law was it necessary and incidental to the offense. So if there was just an offense of separate kidnappings, okay, we're not talking about necessary and incidental. When you're kidnapping somebody with separate victims, those are a separate course of conduct. But once again, if there's another intent, another plan, such as a robbery, and you're looking at whether the kidnapping was done as part of that robbery, or whether it was, I guess there was some other intent involved where the persons were either restrained or kept from leaving, then that question.
So did the jury here make a finding that the primary purpose was robbery as opposed to kidnapping?
Well, they didn't make that specific finding.
They found it was a single course of conduct.
Isn't there actually a jury finding? The situation where there's four people in a car, no merger instruction would. If one was asked, it really shouldn't be given. But in this case, what the judge instructed the jury was, what's the one general intent? Was there one general intent? And they've been charged, the defendant's been charged with robbery and kidnapping, so there is one ultimate intent. And so it's up to the jury to determine, and they did determine, that one general intent was obviously not to do a kidnapping, it was to commit a robbery.
Yes, believe so. And because there was two parts, we believe, to the interrogatory question. One was whether there was just 1 year and 10, and then the second part was whether it was part of a common scheme or plan. And we believe that the jury, based on the evidence that they saw, concluded that they could not see how the kidnapping was separate and apart from the robbery, because the persons who went in, almost as soon as they went in, they went for the ATM machine and the change machine, and the jury concluded that was their only in single intent. And once they had the money recovered from those machines, they immediately left. I believe I'm going to my rebuttal time. I would, as I said, ask for 10 minutes left.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Lum. We'll hear from Mr. Anderson at this point.
Thank you. Good morning. Jim Anderson for the state. Good
morning.
I guess I'll start on the merger. You know, it did come to me during prep for this case that didn't include in my supplemental briefing that I don't think that all the kidnappings could even merge into the rob. The rob only alleged IAIQ, Wing Cho, DBA Wing Cho, IAIQ, Lacunas, and Lemons. Lacunas had a bag stolen from her. Lemons, I believe, had a laptop stolen. And so the only ones, kidnappings that could merge in that count would be the kidnappings involving Lacunas and Lemons. The others, there's only a single intent. There's no robbery of them.
But the jury was specifically instructed and found, based on the instruction, we'd be kind of repudiating the jury's instruction if we were to follow.
I know. We asked for the instruction, you know, it does one merger two, one merger three, one merger three, and four, five. But I think that's wrong. I think that's wrong because count one only alleged three people, and two of them that were involved complaints in the robbery were not included in that. So those cannot merge. They just stand alone. The other, so I'm not really sure what can happen here, to tell you the truth. And I think that you definitely can order the circuit court to reconsider its decision of dismissing count one. The merger went proper at court because the lesser merged into the greater, as is a general rule. Right, because we had a Class A kidnapping at that time, and we had the Rob 2, which was Class B. So,
I'm sorry. So, what does the state believe should happen at this point?
My position is you can ask the circuit court to reconsider its dismissal, since the landscape has now changed. We all have Class Bs now, and it wasn't presented with that scenario at the time it merged. The offenses, and then, from my understanding, is the state has a prerogative to elect which ones merge into which, and I think the only ones that can merge is the two kidnappings involving Lemons and Lacuna into the rob, and then the other two stand alone. The kidnappings stand. So we definitely have two kidnappings probably standing alone.
Now, what's your response to Mr. Lum's argument that? The Padilla case is factually distinguishable because there was no merger instruction given in this case, while here there was one.
I think that's a distinction with no difference, Your Honor. I think the rule is the prosecution, in terms of the prosecution having the prerogative to elect, is that your
That's my understanding. Their rebuttal or their suggestions, to the extent Padilla seemed to sanction such an approach, it was driven by the fact that there was no merger instruction, or at least that door was opened by that fact, which of course, didn't happen here. We had a merger.
Yes, that is a distinction point. But
so, what's your response to that?
My response is the prosecutor still has a prerogative to elect.
So you think Padilla stands for the proposition that the state always gets to choose? It's always the state's option. It's not a matter of law.
A proposition, yes.
Do you think that that's a problem that the state in this situation? Let's assume you're correct. Is it a problem that the state can choose four convictions or one conviction?
We would, of course, we'd rather have four, right?
Yeah. No, I understand that. And I'm just wondering, is that a, you know, is that a due process kind of concern that the government, depending on who the prosecutor is or whatever it is, the government decides, well, I want four convictions on this person, and in another case you might go, I'd rather have one conviction. It just seems sort of an odd...
Unfair to you, Your Honor?
I'm not even asking whether it's fair or unfair. I'm just asking, why should the government, as opposed to the defendant or the judge? In other words, who should choose?
Well, we brought the charge, so I think whatever charge we get, and if they're all the same and they do merge, continuous course of conduct, then I think we should we should be able to choose.
Mr. Anderson,
which ones to keep.
What is your authority for that? I'm sorry. Yeah.
No, it's just from the various cases, but nothing in nothing
what
on
case
point.
Tell says point. That it's the state's option to choose.
Well, just Padilla, I guess. That's
well, that was because there was no merger instruction, and the state was asking, rather than having to face a retrial, the state raised that as an option, which the court adopted. But that's totally distinguishable, don't you think, from this situation in which the jury actually found that counts one and two merged counts one and three. But there was a continuous course of conduct, one general impulse, one intent as to counts one and two, one and three, one and four, and one and five.
True, and I agree with you then. But there's no way the kidnapping counts involving Moliga and Beltran could merge with the robbery.
Why?
Because they weren't even named as part of the complaint.
And or.
No.
In order to commit a crime against AAQ and or Lacuna and or.
Limits.
The general intent could it not be to rob IAQ, and whoever's in there is being tied up inside.
The continuous course.
So you're saying that if they tied up 10, you're saying that if they tied up 15 people in there and there it ended up being a rob one with 15 kidnappings as a class B, it could never merge into rob as a class A.
I'm saying that where there is no intent to steal, commit theft from Moliga and Beltran, there's only a single intent to restrain them, kidnapping with the intent to restrain. I mean, terrorize, sorry, my fault. But
well, I can appreciate, Mr. Anderson, that maybe that's your interpretation of the facts, but it seemed as though the jury, in looking at all the facts, felt that there was a course of conduct that was controlled by one intent. But in that regard, in terms of how to look at the merger alternatives here and whether or not there should be a merger in which there ends up with multiple convictions as opposed to less than multiple convictions, to what extent do you think that it is necessary to consider the policy under 701-109, the commentary stating that 701-109 reflects a policy to limit the possibility of multiple convictions and extended sentence where the defendant has engaged in one course of conduct? Wouldn't that suggest that the court, rather than the prosecutor, should apply that consideration and make a determination as to the way the merger should proceed?
I see your point. But I don't know if it's accurate. I really don't, actually, now.
I want to take you back to your comment about Justice Wilson's prior question, that the jury found one intent between count one and counts two, three, four, and five, single intent. Your comment was the jury was wrong. But does that mean we can ignore that finding, or what's the basis for ignoring that finding?
I think you can because it was wrong, Your Honor. I don't know. There's no way that those two kidnapping counts could merge with a robbery count that doesn't include them as complainants.
Did the state's application for certiorari request retrial on the grounds that the jury was wrong?
No, I just thought of this. I just told you, ma'am. I just thought of this while prepping for this oral argument.
So the state is requesting that the court notice this as plain error? Is that what you're suggesting?
Sure, it's right, I think, yes. Of course.
So,
what this argument should be about, I think.
So the substantial rights that are being affected here are, if it's plain error, what substantial rights are we talking about?
Well, the orderly justice. Yes. What is legal? What is proper?
But I'm not so sure your argument holds.
Okay.
I understand that only two of the folks are named, but as Justice McKenna, when she was reading it to you, she said committing a theft from IAQ. So as long as the jury thought that in all through counts 2 through 5 with each individual, as long as the jury believed that that person was being restrained and terrorized as part of one plan and one intent to commit a robbery against IAQ, then they could merge.
With all due respect, Your Honor, it's Wayne Cho, DBA, IAQ, and or Lacunas, and or Lemons. Only those three entities, I believe. Didn't include Maliga or Beltran. I don't think just by saying IAQ that you include those two, because they nothing was taken from them. So,
Mr. Anderson, could I?
Nothing is taken from the.
From
the
Maliga. Oh, yeah.
No, but something's taken from IAQ.
Sure. Definitely.
So they could restrain it. It's just like a bank robbery. If you go into a bank robbery, I think we have a case here. If you go into a bank and you put up your gun and you tell all the tellers to freeze and you take the money from the bank, it's one robbery.
No, true. Bank. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And if you were to charge every teller kidnapping, the jury could merge whether you named them all or you didn't.
Well, they. Yes, we named the specific ones that the robbery was committed against, and all of them were kidnapped and put in the corner at the back of the room initially before the robbery began.
I think what I'd like to go back to my question, because
okay.
And I'm not disputing your answer, just I'm not certain about the approach. I think, I don't know if it's the Martin case or something, but there's a doctrine that says if the prosecution is given full authority whether to charge a misdemeanor or a felony, they're not to have that unbridled discretion.
Oh, of course. Okay. Of course.
Why isn't that similar to here, where we're giving full authority to choose whether or not a defendant should have one conviction or four?
Well, I think they're all the same class felonies, and so that other argument, you know, doesn't really fit, sir.
Should maybe the rule of lenity apply? I mean, if there's an ambiguity here about which way it should go, that if the legislature hasn't made it clear and which way it should merge or how many convictions a person has, doesn't that, and I think you would acknowledge, maybe a prosecutor would decide, I'd rather have this one conviction versus four based because of certain reasons. In other words, if a government official could decide this different ways, I'm wondering whether the rule of lenity would require that it be applied only in one way.
Well, it does apply in the situation you said, the Modica issue, right?
Right.
The felony.
Right.
But it doesn't, I don't think it should apply here. They're all the same class felonies, and they did, and defendants did kidnap each and every person.
It would make no difference to a defendant as to whether or not he is convicted on five class Bs or one class B?
Sure it would, ma'am. Yes.
Right.
Indeed. And we'd like to keep those. In fact, we wouldn't mind keeping the robbery in which two kidnappings merged and two kidnappings.
I think actually. Just the variety of alternatives.
Yeah.
Kind of reflects the concern.
Yes.
So we could have different courts coming up with different results depending on the judge's inclination or the prosecutor's choice. That doesn't sound to me like a real equitable way to reach a resolution. And I understand you didn't create this.
No.
That's for sure.
But the initial merger was correct, I believe, you know, because it was only merged into count two.
I understand.
Yeah, okay.
Mr. Anderson, would you provide your view as to why the judge, having found that the prior bad act of David Tao of smashing the face of an individual into a windshield and also having murdered somebody, would be relevant to the defense of duress, or in terms of the choice of evil, relevant to the defense that the defendant was afraid of physical injury, but would not permit the additional evidence that Tao had said that he was out of jail, and also the additional evidence that the defendant believed that Tao was a strong arm collecting money for organized crime.
I think this goes to the discretion of the trial court. I think initially when this came in, after the case had been going on for 4 years and it came in 2 weeks before, the court was obviously suspect about the uncorroborated points.
But if if the court was suspect about uncorroborated points, wouldn't it be more of a potential reason to question the evidence if it had to do with serious conduct like murder and a rather severe assault where a person's face was smashed into a windshield? Wouldn't the court be more apprehensive about letting that uncorroborated testimony come in than the uncorroborated testimony dealing with him saying he was just got out of jail or was a strong arm?
Because all those other things were just general things, the debt collector and enforcer and all that, were just general bad acts, but not really understood personally by Deguerre to have him fear for his safety if he didn't comply with engaging in the robbery. He was allowed to bring in the Tao things because he saw it. He allegedly saw a Tao smash a guy's head against the a car, and Tao said, look, you want to see this happen to you? And the court also allowed, out of the blue, Deguerre's assertion that he had seen Wu kill a human being, another person, and said, sure, that can come in too as evidence of your duress. But they didn't bring that up.
Well, with respect to admissibility, I mean, the intent is what was at issue when these prior bad acts were being, albeit general bad acts, maybe acting as a strong arm, but these were acts that were meant to show the intent of the defendant, correct?
True, and I think the court found that what it allowed was sufficient to show, that he feared, his duress, that went to his duress defense.
Except that the decision of the court omitted testimony that the defendant thought that Mr. Tao and Mr. Wu were engaged in strong arm on behalf of a criminal organization.
I think that was a discretionary call, Your Honor. But I think because it didn't impede the court's ruling.
Was it discretion? The discretion was exercised, you think, because it lacked reliability, because it was just a general statement?
I think so. Not entirely. I think the late notice. So the court didn't even, I don't think the court, I mean, I can't say, but it just seemed like the court didn't even believe this stuff. But it would allow certain things so as not to, disparage the duress defense, just not general acts of bad character.
Thank you.
Nothing else?
All the further questions, and if nothing else from you, Mr. Anderson, thank you very much.
I hope the motion to suppress is good. I think it was plain view, absolutely. I think that's very clear. We've gone over the motion to eliminate. The mistrial, the remark about firing range, I guess that's not too problematic for you, Justice Pollack? Good. We all go to firing range. It's not a bad act. All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Lum.
Thank you again. Just to, I guess, kind of address some points. It seems when the prosecutor says that because, I guess, Obliga and Beltran were left out of the description and consequent robbery that they're not covered by merger. It just seems the prosecutor is trying to carve out a lot of power for itself because it could avoid any kind of, under this scenario, it could avoid any kind of 71-109 problem by just keeping it separate. They could say that we're just charging robbery of IALQ on the count one and leave out mention of any individual's names, and then just put them in the kidnapping counts, and said if there was four, five, or even 15 other individuals, also charge those as separate kidnappings, and that way, I guess, skirt around the 71-109 problem. I think that does become a matter of due process, whether it's giving the prosecutor all this power right from the start of the case all to the ending. no matter what kind of ruling the jury finds.
Of course, that's not what, I'm sorry. That's not what happened here, because according to Mr. Anderson, the prosecution said IAIQ, the owner, DBAIQ, and two of the four individuals who were kidnapped. What's your response to his argument that with regard to the other two who were not identified in the indictment as having been a subject to a robbery, that those counts cannot merge as a matter of law, that we should draw a distinction between those two kidnapping victims and the other two?
Well, the focus should be whether there was a single intent or plan in a continuing course of conduct, and the prosecutor did agree at trial to give those interrogatories to the jury. And basically, you know, if they agree to give those interrogatories, they have to live with the jury's findings. In this case, the jury was not limited to just findings regarding Bakuna and Lemons. They were asked whether there was the same intent or plan as to count one and count two, count one and count three, count four and count five, and count one and count four, and count one and count five. So they addressed all of those. And so if the prosecutor did not object and agreed to those interrogatory questions to the jury, when the jury comes back with the finding that there was the single intent or plan, we're saying that it's only fair to require the prosecutor to abide by those findings that were made by the 12-person jury unanimously.
What if there were three separate robbery counts?
Well, I guess if they try to phrase the robbery counts involving, once again, different victims, then it would be, once again, up to the jury if the jury found that, because, once again, our argument is when the jury made its finding on the Rob Second, basically they were concluding that the only intent for going into the IAQ that day was just to take the money from the cash register, the ATM machines, and the change machines, that they were not out there to go in there with that intent to rob specific individuals. And so if the jury came to that conclusion, once again, that's the one we have to live with.
Mr. Lum, perhaps you could respond to the point that Mr. Anderson made, that the excluded acts, prior bad acts, were of a generalized nature and therefore would not qualify for admission, as opposed to acts that were specifically observed by Mr. Deguerre.
Well, we believe that what Deguerre believed, especially as to his knowledge of their reputation of what these persons go through and Theo had done in the past, does go to his state of mind on both choice of evils and duress.
If it goes to state of mind, then there's a continuing question under the abuse of discretion standard as to whether the exclusion actually caused a substantial detriment. And given the evidence that was admitted that showed some aggressive, dangerous behavior, at least as testified to by Deguerre, what difference does it really make? Is it a substantial detriment that those other acts were excluded?
We believe so. What actually only came in was the prior incident regarding Deguerre's just seeing Teo smashing that individual's face into the windshield. But once again, when he's saying that he knows that these persons are involved in those strong army activities and debt collection, that it's basically saying that using force for criminal activities is part of their, both Teo's and Wu's way of operating. And he would fully expect that if he didn't cooperate, that those same kind of things would happen to him. We don't believe it's cumulative. It's actually shows the also once again it ties in with the fact that he believed these persons were somehow connected with the persons who are employees at the AIQ, and that's why that it would be an inside job, and that no persons were actually going to be harmed.
Is it correct that evidence was excluded that Mr. Wu beat several people with a metal pipe?
Yes, that one was another statement that Daguerre was going to make, and we believe that...
Did Daguerre see that, or was it his understanding that it had happened through other sources?
Well, looking at the, motion, it does not specifically say whether Daguerre himself specifically or eyewitness of that event. However, it's a specific act which would once again go to his knowledge of their use of violence. And once again, the fact that it was near that ABC junkyard, which is where person Wu worked, and where Mr. Guerra met up with Wu and Tao, would add to the relevance that Wu was engaging all these activities in the IAEA area and was sort of not exactly an overlord, but that he had certain control over activities that happened in that area. I would like to address the mistrial, because the court did strike the questioning regarding going to the Copperhead firing range to shoot guns with Tao, and what we're saying is that the court should have gone farther rather than striking it, should have granted the mistrial, because the court itself characterized it as an ambush, because there had been a motion in limine, and despite the motion that the prosecutors still brought that question up. Another part is
was the question even answered?
We don't believe so.
And it was stricken and the jury was told to disregard?
Yes, Your Honor. But once again, the court itself believed that it was an ambush, so it shows that the prosecutor basically had no grounds for asking that question in the first place, and the proper remedy should have been a mistrial at that point in time. Next, regarding the motion to suppress, there was the motion to suppress, and what was raised was that the detectives that were involved, they did state that he had seen that bulletin regarding the IAQ robbery. It's just that when they went to the hotel room, it was supposedly just to focus on that other incident regarding the firearms, and the search warrant only mentioned about the firearms. Given the knowledge that they had before going in, we don't think that it is credible that they were just going to that hotel room focusing just on whether there was prohibited firearms there. We believe that they were focusing already on the glare and that they were looking for anything that they could tie into him, and that they should have gotten a search warrant if they're going to seize the other items that were allegedly connected with the IAQ robbery.
Mr. Lum, your time expired, but if you have any final thoughts that you wish to share with us, you may.
Well, again, we're basically asking for the new trial. We will be based on, the trial court's rulings on the evidence, especially the motion to eliminate, but if there's going to be a resentencing, we believe that it should just be on the robbery second trial.
Very well. Thank you very much. Thank you to both of our attorneys here today. The court will take this matter under advisement.